Hello, everybody. This is Keith Music Man Henlick with the Final on Vinyl podcast. And today we have a guest that has been in the music industry for several years now. And his name is Holland Holmes. And he recently released Sacred Places in January 12th of this year. Welcome aboard, Holland.
Thank you very much for having me, Keith. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too. And I appreciate your time. So before we jump in on the album, which I absolutely loved and have a lot of interest in how you created it, just maybe a little background on your jump into a new world in music and how that all began and some of your influences and things of that nature. Would love to hear that.
Yeah. So I grew up in a family with very diverse musical interests. My sister, of course, listened to popular rock. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. And my father was a country and western fan, and my mother was more of a contemporary, had interests in contemporary music like Chicago and Burt Bacharach and Henry Mancini, that kind of thing. So I was exposed to a lot of different kinds of music growing up, which I think is pretty cool. One of the big things is that I grew up with a piano in my house, and at a very, very early age, as a toddler, my mother said that I would climb up, and I just gravitated towards it. I was drawn to it. I just fell in love with it at a very early age. Never really took any lessons, so I'm self-taught in that respect, but me and some friends of mine in high school got together when we turned 18 and formed a band, and we played popular rock and roll of the 80s. But then I developed an interest in wanting to create my own work, write my own songs and that kind of thing. And none of my bandmates were really all that. We did some, but they weren't that interested in it. And that's really where I wanted to go as a musician. And so, yeah, I was in a few bands over the years through the 80s and 90s. But again, running into the problem of no one really wanting to write the kind of material that I wanted to write. So I basically sat out on my own. On a canoe trip in 1981, I think, 81 or 82. This was my first year in college, so it would have been 81. The guy that was driving the van that we were all riding in, stuck a cassette tape in, and this music started playing, and I was like, oh my gosh, what is that music? Well, it turns out it was Jean-Michel Jarre, and I had never heard anything like that. Yeah.
Love him.
Yeah. So I just really enamored with that kind of music. I'd never heard it before. I hadn't really been exposed to Kraftwerk or Klaus Schulze or any of those guys. So Jean-Michel was my first real exposure to that sort of eclectic type of progressive electronic music. That was wildly popular in Europe at the time, but I just didn't know that much about it. And then a couple of years later, on a rock climbing trip out in the desert of West Texas, another friend of mine stuck a cassette in, played it, and this time it was Underwater Sunlight from Tangerine Dream.
And, another one of my favorites. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
So it just... It was like, where is this stuff? Where's it coming from? And it was kind of hard to find here in the States because they didn't sell that kind of music that much. But I did manage to start getting a hold of some of this music. And then in, I think it was around 89 or 90, I used to have a subscription to Keyboard magazine, and in the back of an issue of Keyboard was a tiny little, they would do these little one or two paragraph sort of reviews of new music. And one of them was Western Spaces from Steve Roach, Kevin Burhini, Richard Bermer. And it talked about this song called The Breathing Stone. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. I want to know what that's about. So I managed to find the cassette of that. And again, just totally flipped out, just fell in love with it. And so that was my introduction to Steve Roach and Richard Bermer and Brahini and so many others. And I started exploring a lot of other artists, but I knew at that point that that is what I wanted to do with my music. And in fact, I knew that back when I discovered Jar and Tangerine Dream. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do. To backtrack just a little bit, I was always exploring this kind of music on my own, but never really finished anything, never put out an album, never made enough tracks to, I didn't have a home studio per se. I had a Tascam 4-track cassette recorder, and you could, if you were careful, you could bounce it a few times and get 6, 7, maybe 8 tracks before it started just, you know, falling apart with fuzz and stretch and noise. But I had, and I've still got these old cassettes. They're barely audible now, but a lot of musical ideas from the 80s and 90s that I had explored and never used. And every now and then I'll grab one and, you know, run with it and develop it and put it on an album. But that's how I started. So I've had an interest in this music for a very long time, and didn't start actually doing anything with it in earnest until about 2007, when I started putting together a formidable computer and getting the software that was necessary. If you had told me that we would be able to do what we can do now as musicians in 1981, I wouldn't have believed you. To be a musician now, it's a wonderful time for anyone who wants to make music, because it's all the tools are at our fingertips to create very, very high quality music and reach a very, very large audience. And that's certainly been a large part of why I have any popularity at all. Yeah.
That's very true. And it is a wonderful thing. And, you know, I make reference to Tangerine Dream and Kraftwerk a lot, because I'm hearing a lot of this music over the past couple of years, and those are the first two that pop into my mind. But Jean-Michel Jarre is another great artist who set the foundation for some of the things that we hear today and the influences that, you know, came through to you as well. And do you have any of the vinyls?
Absolutely.
Like that? Do you have any vinyls by Jean-Michel Jarre or any of the other artists?
I had some Tangerine Dream vinyl. I didn't have any Jar records, but I had 2 or 3 of the Tangerine Dream on vinyl. And of course, Pink Floyd, Rush, some of those bands that were also an influence to me. Like an idiot, I got rid of all my vinyl in the late 90s when it became obsolete.
I did the same thing.
Oh my gosh, I hate myself for doing that, because these would be worth so much money now. And just, you know, in retrospect, they have so much sentimental value to me. I wish I could, I wish I had them back, but no, sadly, I let them go.
Well, so, I definitely replaced my missing albums over the years and have more than I can possibly listen to, which is a blessing. So I look at it. So your album, you know, I heard those influences obviously, and it was, you know, in fact, there was one song there, I went, oh my God, this is like Tangerine Dream, you know, just some very cool things. And, you know, when I wrote the review, which I'm going to post today with this interview, by the way,
Thank you.
it really was the first four songs. It pulled me in right away out of order, out of chaos. And it was the first four that just really hit me like, wow, this is amazing. And
Thank you.
basically got me in that mindset of what was happening in my listening experience. And it just took off from there. And God, if I would have kept going the way I was going, I would have had a four-page review and then lost my audience. So I had to stop. But you use some very interesting hardware and software. Is that something you're able to talk about or want to talk about?
Sure, yeah. So all my music centers around sound design. And what I like to do is come up with, I use 90%, 95% of the sounds that I use are my own. Even if I start with, say, a stock patch from Omnisphere and start tweaking it myself. But I always like to bend it sort of to my needs. But I love to explore sound creation and sound design. And what happens more often than not is that the sound will dictate its use and its sort of formation into a certain sequence or a certain chord structure. So when I listen to the sound, it sort of tells me what it needs and what it wants to do in a song, instead of thinking of a song and then trying to create a sound for it. I generally, everything comes from the sound more often than not. I use and have in the past used primarily software to create the music that I create, but in the last few years, I've been moving more and more into the hardware realm just because I enjoy it so much. It's a lot more engaging and interesting to me to turn knobs and push sliders around and play keys than it is to roll a mouse around on a pad. That's just the bottom line, is it's just so much more fun to play the hardware. And it makes me a better musician too, to spend more time at the keyboard and more time. I have a rather large analog modular system that I've built over the years, and it is becoming very much front and center of what I'm doing these days. And so there will be much more of that in the future. But this particular album, Sacred Places, was done. Probably three quarters of it used software, and that includes, like I said, Omnisphere, Arturia Pigments, pretty much everything that Reason comes with, the Reason software. That's my primary DAW. I spend also a lot of time working on sequences in the software, just through experimentation. And it's weird. Sometimes a song will come together in literally in a few hours, I'll have the foundation for it, you know, pretty much fleshed out. And other times I'll work on a song over the course of months or even years. Generally speaking, I can get an album done in 5 or 6 months. And this one came together actually fairly quickly. So it just it you never know where these musical ideas are going to come from, how they're going to develop, what inspires me. It can be any number of things. But it fascinates me. It's a mystery to me where I get these ideas. People always ask me, how do you come up with this music? I don't know, Keith. I just don't know. You know, we all have skills in this life, and mine happens to be, I guess, you know, being able to think of things in a musical sense. And I do this because I enjoy it so much. I derive a great deal of satisfaction from this creative process. And I don't know if it's ego that drives me or what it is, but I love to share my creations, and to have been able to find even a small audience for my work is just, I'm just blessed beyond words that people want to hear what I'm doing. And I just love making it.
I tell you, after I listened to it, I said to myself, I would love to hear this on vinyl. I absolutely would love it.
Well, yeah, I would too, actually. That is a fairly expensive endeavor, but I would certainly love to make it happen one day for sure, at least once. One of the things, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I love so much about vinyl that I think is lost on this generation is the visual real estate that came with buying an album. You had basically a 12-inch work of art. If you wanted it to be, if the musician, you know, but like think of a Yes album. I can't imagine a Yes album or listening to Yes without picturing Roger Dean's artwork on the front of those, the truly beautiful art that came with so many of these albums.
Absolutely.
And that's, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm also an artist. I like to paint. And so I have a deep appreciation for the art that comes along with a lot of the music that we buy. And even CDs provided that for a long time. But now CDs are going away. So how do I incorporate that whole, you know, experience of hearing the music and seeing a visual that accompanies it, which helps to sort of form a spiritual relationship with the music and sort of spawns your own visualizations. I don't mind that people can listen to my music and formulate their own ideas on what the music means to them. I love that. I think that's important, because that's how music connects with people. I don't want to force my opinion on anyone, but being able to create art and include it in the experience of listening to my music, it's pretty important. So moving forward, we'll have to find ways to ensure that happens. And one of those ways, of course, is music videos, which I love making as well.
Yeah. Right. All very well said. And, you know, just thinking about everything that you said and not really understanding of how this happens in the process is, I look at life like there are choices laid in front of us, and we make certain choices. And for you, you found who you were. You plugged into that esoteric thing, whatever it is, a collective consciousness, God, or whatever you want to call it. And you were fortunate enough that it actually worked, and you're blessed, and you're sharing that blessing with everybody, which is a really cool thing. So,
yeah. Joseph Campbell said, follow your muse. And I think that's important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Holland, it's been wonderful speaking with you. I certainly appreciate your time. I know the audience will love to hear what you have to say and listen to your music. And I wish you well, sir, and look forward to any releases you have coming up down the road.
Well, thank you very much, Keith. And I'm deeply honored that you took the time to listen to me talk. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I wish the best for you as well, sir.
Thank you. You can take care now.
Okay, you too. Thanks.
Bye.